who will welcome for our second oral argument this morning, Edison Middle School from Milwaukee. Would you raise your hands, please? Well, it's good having you with us. And now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to everyone here. On my far left this time is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. And to my immediate left is Justice William Babich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right is Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. There are photographs of the court and information on that photograph, as well as summaries of the case you are hearing. They're available outside, although I think you also got them at school. With that, we shall proceed with the next case, which is a tax case. Lincoln Savings Bank versus the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, number 96-0135. Robert Schnurr is representing the Lincoln Savings Bank.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Schnurr from Milwaukee, and I am indeed representing Lincoln Savings, which is the taxpayer in this action. We are appealing, of course, from an adverse decision of the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, in turn, had reversed the Circuit Court, which had held for the taxpayer. The Circuit Court had reversed the Tax Appeals Commission, which had been held for the Department. And, of course, this is an appeal of the Tax Appeals Commission's decision. Starting in 1987, Wisconsin substantially changed its method of taxing corporations doing business in this state, moving from a separate computation regime whereby a taxpayer would utilize Wisconsin rules, Wisconsin definitions to reach its taxable income. Starting in 87, we moved to a federalized regime by which a taxpayer would determine its federal income first, and then with relatively few plus or minus modifications, that would be the taxpayer's Wisconsin income as well. This case involves the impact of that change on Wisconsin's savings and loan industry. More specifically, it involves the meaning and purpose of Section 3047(1A) of the 1987 Federalization Act. And that section came about because the legislature, at the time it moved Wisconsin from a separate computation system to a federalized system, recognized that without more, that was going to cause problems, distortion problems caused by timing differences. And so Section 347(1A) was added to the 1987 Act. And the purpose of that section was indeed to remedy the problems that would otherwise have occurred as a result of federalization. Now, even more specifically, this case involves the application of Section 3047(1A) to savings and loan associations utilizing the reserve method of accounting for their bad debts.
Okay.
I just want to ask you
yes, Your Honor,
to explain so that not only can I understand it, but everybody from Edison Middle School can understand what a bad debt reserve is and how it's calculated under the federal income tax rule. And I want to know if it's different from banks than it is from other corporations.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be happy to do that. The taxpayer is in the business of making loans, mainly to individuals who are borrowing in order to build homes.
A bank lends money.
A savings and loan lends money.
So my question was, does this cover all financial institutions, banks, savings and loans, credit unions, the whole?
No, Your Honor, because savings and loan associations had, under federal law, a very distinct method of taxing bad debts and bad debt reserves, and those were not applicable to other types of financial institutions.
Okay, that answers the second question. So we're only dealing with savings and loans in this case, not all corporations or individuals with reserves.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Bad debts. Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, obviously, we all know that when a savings and loan makes a loan, occasionally those loans go bad. They cannot be collected, that the borrowers cannot repay those loans. And we also know that that is a cost of doing business for a savings and loan. And it can reduce, it can take a deduction for those bad debts. Now, there's
If I don't pay my mortgage and you have to take that, you get a bad loan, then you deduct $10,000.
Your Honor, there are two separate methods by which savings and loans are able to handle their bad debts. One is indeed what was called the specific charge-off method, so that a savings and loan would wait until a loan actually did become uncollectible. And at that point, a deduction would be taken.
That's the $10,000 example I just gave you. Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The other way is?
The other way is to use a reserve method. And under the reserve method, which both Wisconsin and federal law permitted, a savings and loan could claim a deduction every year that it was in business. The deduction would be determined by a variety of different formulae, but it was not dependent upon an actual debt going bad in that particular year. It would take a deduction. The deduction would be added to a bad debt reserve. And then when an actual bad debt occurred, instead of being deducted, because in a sense it had already been deducted under the reserve method, instead of being deducted, it would be charged to the bad debt reserve.
What does that mean? I mean, you say it's charged. You don't have an additional deduction for federal income tax. Do you have a reduction of that bad debt reserve?
Yes.
You've already paid that out?
Yes, no, that's exactly right, Your Honor, that the deductions that were claimed over the years would increase the bad debt reserve. And then if there was an actual bad debt, it would actually constitute a reduction to that reserve.
Okay, so your reserve is $1 million. You've now paid out $500,000 that year. So now your reserve is $500,000.
Except to the extent that there may be additional, new additions to that reserve that we permitted in that year.
Now, you've loaned out $2 million, and so your reserve is now back up $500,000, and then so you stay at $1 million. What do you deduct for federal income tax that year?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch your hint.
You had $1 million reserve for federal income tax purposes. You've now paid out $500,000 that year, so you're actual reserve is only $500,000, but you've made $2-3 million alone. So now, under these calculations, you're up $500,000 on your reserve. So you deduct nothing that year.
No, you can't really tell, Your Honor, because the way the formulae work is there's a number of different type formulae that determine how much of an addition can be made to the reserve in each year.
But it's possible that what you actually paid out equals what that formula
is. It is indeed possible.
That's the example I gave you. Okay.
Yes, and if under the statutes the appropriate reserve addition was another, let's say, $500,000, that would get the reserve back up to $1 million.
Well, now, your definition of the reserve fits with your legal argument of looking to the future, that $1 million in reserve is as of this year. Doesn't matter what it was 10 years ago or 30 years ago or 200 years ago.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Your Honor, because, I think this really gets to the very heart of this case, because if you take a garden variety business deduction, it reduces your income, but it has no impact on later years. if you take a bad debt reserve deduction, what it is doing is creating a bad debt reserve. And that reserve, as demonstrated in the example I just went through with the Chief Justice, that reserve will affect the taxpayer's later income. And in fact, that's the whole purpose of bad debt reserve and bad debt reserve accounting, is not that a taxpayer can permanently reduce its income by the additions it makes to its bad debt reserve. Rather, it's just accelerating, it's speeding up those deductions, it's taking them in earlier years, because the price of taking those additions and reducing your income in those years is to increase your income in later years, because as we've just seen, when an actual bad debt occurs under this method, it won't generate a deduction in that later year. And that, I think, very much does go to the heart of our case, which is that the deductions, the approximately $300,000 of deductions, which I will get to in a moment, those $300,000 of deductions not only reduced the taxpayer's income, but they also increased his bad debt reserve with his potential future impact.
Counsel, you say the heart of the case in part focuses on the purpose of the statute. Am I understanding you correct? Remedial versus prospective?
Oh, I think that's a very important aspect of the case, Your Honor.
I need assistance in understanding the argument, because although you argue that you look to the future, that this is prospective, at the same time, in your arguments, you use the term remedial. It's remedial. And normally, when we think of remedial, we think of to cure a past wrong. Now, that's important in this case because of the rules of construction. If it's remedial, it's liberally construed in favor of the taxpayer, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me in your arguments, you consistently blend that terminology. You started today. The purpose, you said, was to remedy problems, I think of past, that would have occurred in the future. Page 15 of your brief, you do the same thing. The purpose is a remedial statute, you say, enacted by the legislature for the sole purpose of remedying, and I put in parentheses, in the past, the tax distortions and inequities that would otherwise have been created by the change to the federalized tax regime. So I get mixed up as to whether this is remedial, focusing on taking care of something in the past, which has certain standards of application, or is it prospective?
Well, I think it's remedial, Your Honor, but it is remedial in a prospective sense. It is intended to remedy problems that are going to be created by federalization in 1987 and subsequent years. And we get there by just citing from the statute that we're dealing with, which says, and I won't obviously read the whole thing, each corporation shall calculate as of the close of its taxable year 86, which was the last year of the pre-federalization period, shall calculate the amount that, and this is the key to in our position, the amount that because of this act is required to be added to or subtracted from income in order to avoid double inclusion or emission of income, in order to avoid these distortions. So the act is looking solely to distortions, using a shorthand term for double emissions or double inclusions of income and omissions. It's only focusing on distortions which are caused by the Federalization Act. And therefore, by its very nature, that is looking forward and that is going to be prospective. If there were past differences between the state and federal laws, and if those have no potential for impacting on post-federalization income, well, if that was our case, we would not be here today, because those past differences were created by past differences in the laws. They were not created by federalization. Now, at the time...
Mr. Snurr, let me ask you some questions just to get some background. It's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that prior to January of 1962, that you did not have, that there was no such thing as a bad debt reserve deduction under Wisconsin law. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, because savings and loans were exempt from Wisconsin income taxes prior to 1962.
When did your client then first have a bad debt reserve deduction under Wisconsin law, and what was that amount?
It would be 1962, Your Honor, the first date of the... the first year in which they became subject to tax, and their addition to their reserve in 1962 was $22,000 for Wisconsin purposes.
But the Federal Reserve at that date was higher. $309,000 higher.
Yes, the Federal Reserve was higher in this case for two reasons. It was, to one extent, because since the taxpayer had been subject to federal income tax in pre-62 years and had been taking deductions against its federal income tax, as of 1962, it already had $300,000 in its bad debt reserve. Now, in addition to that, between 62 and 86, which is when federalization occurred, the Federal Reserve increased by another $700,000 approximately faster than the Wisconsin Reserve. And the reason for that was is that during that interim period, the federal statutes just allowed a more liberal bad debt reserve deduction than Wisconsin. So as of the eve of federalization, there was approximately a $1 million difference between the taxpayer's Federal Reserve, which is about $1 million higher than its Wisconsin bad debt reserve.
Now, you and the Department of Revenue agree about that $1 million. I mean, there's no dispute that there was $1 million plus.
Yes, right.
You disagree as to whether you should be able to take the whole million or whether you should only take the $700,000, which accrued between 62 and 87.
That's correct, Your Honor, because what happened is in 1986, because of federalization, the reserves were equalized. The taxpayer automatically, as a result of the Federalization Act, had to and did in fact increase its Wisconsin reserve by that $1 million to equal the existing Federal Reserve so that the parties would go forward with equal reserves. The taxpayer's position is that under Section 3047.1A, when its Wisconsin reserve was automatically bumped by this $1 million on account of federalization, that it was entitled under Section 3047.1A to a $1 million reserve addition deduction for Wisconsin purposes at that time. Now, the department's position basically looked under its sort of its look-back approach. The Wisconsin Department and the Tax Appeals Commission have from the beginning insisted that Section 3047.1A was only intended to remedy past differences between the state and federal laws. It was a look-backward statute and not a look-forward statute. And if you accept that premise, they're correct. We wouldn't be here today that the taxpayer would only be entitled to a $700,000 deduction because the first $300,000 was deducted in years the taxpayer was not subject to Wisconsin tax, and therefore there's no need for a catch-up deduction. However, our point, as I've already made reference to, is that Section 3047.1A is not a look-back statute at all. Those differences over the years did not occur because of this act, which is the Wisconsin, the language in the Wisconsin law, in Section 3047.1A. What did occur because of federalization was the $1 million increase in the taxpayers' bad debt reserve, Wisconsin bad debt reserve, that automatic increase. Our position, reading Section 3047.1a as looking forward, says that we are entitled to that entire, to take a deduction for that $1 million. And we suggest that we're entitled to that on this look-forward theory for three really rather closely related reasons. First of all, the whole nature of a bad debt reserve, as I've just explained, is to reflect deductions that have been taken in the past. That's the definition, that's the purpose, that's the function of bad debt reserves. Bad debt reserves are intended to equal the tax benefits that have been accrued in the past because of bad debt reserve additions. What the department is proposing to do here is to sever that link and to say, no, you have to increase your bad debt reserve by $1 million. That's required by federalization. But we're not going to allow you to deduct that entire million. We're only going to allow you to deduct $700,000, even though, as I just said, that other $300,000 was never deducted. Now, another reason, maybe even getting more to the fundamentals of this, goes to what I said earlier about bad debt reserves being or bad debt reserve function being a system of income deferral rather than permanent income reduction. When the taxpayer deducted those $300,000 pre-62, it not only reduced its federal income in those years, it also created a bad debt reserve of that amount, and if that reserve functions in the way it's supposed to, over the corporate life of the taxpayer, that $300,000 at some point is going to come back in income because it wasn't a permanent deferral, a permanent reduction. It was just a deferral.
Isn't that speculative?
It's only speculative, Your Honor, if you assume that the savings and loan will exist until the end of time or until in perpetuity and will never redeem its stock, will never do the normal kind of things that bad debt reserves are intended to encompass. The whole nature, the point that I'm trying to make, of the bad debt reserve is to reflect the benefits that you've gotten in the past so that those benefits can be reversed in the future.
Arguably here, there is no benefit in the past for pre-1962 because there was no tax and therefore there was no deduction. That's the way the Court of Appeals sees it.
That's certainly true for Wisconsin purposes.
That's what I'm talking about for Wisconsin.
Yes, exactly.
Purposes.
But there was a benefit for federal purposes, and that $300,000 for federal purposes will someday, over the life of the taxpayer, till someday come back into its income, and that's the way it's supposed to work for federal purposes. The problem for Wisconsin purposes is exactly, Your Honor, what you just stated, which is that by federalization, by increasing our bad debt reserve by the full million, now that full million someday will come back into our income for federal and Wisconsin purposes, even though we've only gotten a tax benefit for $700,000 of that. And that, we suggest, is the distortion at which Section 3047A1A was intended to remedy, and the easy remedy is just to do what people always do when they increase their bad debt reserves. They take a deduction for it. That's our position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schnurr. Ms. Sutherland, representing the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
May it please the Court, my name is Laura Sutherland and I represent the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. This case presents a relatively straightforward question of statutory construction, and that is what effect should be given to a transitional adjustment provision which was enacted at the time that Wisconsin federalized its corporate income tax code.
Would you make sure to speak up, please?
Certainly, Justice. Lincoln Savings Bank is asking this court to grant to it a windfall tax deduction based on a set of hypotheticals that, as of 1997, 11 years since federalization occurred, have still not taken place. The Department of Revenue, in stark contrast, is asking this court to affirm its assessment that Lincoln Savings Bank is only entitled to deductions for the years in which it was actually taxed in Wisconsin. No inequity has occurred in this case. Since 1987, the bad debt reserves for Lincoln Savings Bank at the state and federal level have automatically been equalized, and Lincoln Savings Bank has been enjoying the benefit of that larger federal tax deduction ever since that time. Lincoln has argued today that this provision, the adjustment provision, is remedial, that it was intended to address the problems caused by federalization. The department would dispute that characterization. No problems have resulted for Lincoln Savings Bank from federalization. Indeed, Lincoln Savings Bank is in a significantly better financial position from a tax perspective today than it was in 1987.
Well, let me ask you, if they had done this in 1962, and there was $309,000 or whatever sitting out there, and there was nothing for the state, would they have given credit for $309,000, or would it be the same problem? In other words, let's say they had federalized in 62 rather than in 87, but there was still, Lincoln had already had the $300,000 there. What would they have done? Wouldn't they have given them credit for that at that time?
If I understand the question correctly, it is, would this problem have existed had the federalization occurred in 1962? And I think the answer to that question is indeed yes, because in 1961, the year that would have been preceding 1962, Lincoln Savings Bank would not have been subjected to Wisconsin tax.
Well, that I understand, but wouldn't they have gotten the credit if they were going to equalize or account for the, no longer have any modification? They already had, that's where the $300,000 came from,
right.
1962.
And then it just would have set back earlier the date at which the reserves would have become equalized. In 62, then, it would have been $300,000.
Ms. Sutherland, let me just ask Justice Wilcox's question somewhat differently. We're now setting up a 1962 income tax for savings and loan in Wisconsin, okay? They haven't had one before, right? Okay. Now, there's a federal bad debt reserve of $309,000 for federal income tax purposes. So for Wisconsin tax purposes, starting in 62, we're going to give the Lincoln Savings and Loan a $309,000 bad debt reserve. So we've equalized it. The question is, are you going to let them deduct that from the 62 income?
No.
No. You're going to treat them the same way as you want to treat them in 87.
That's correct.
Your point?
That's correct.
Why?
And the reason for that is because the adjustment provision allows a taxpayer to claim a deduction that had previously been omitted. In that scenario, just as in the scenario that exists presently before the court, there would have been no deduction at the Wisconsin tax level that would have been omitted.
But does that make a difference statutory? That's what I'm saying with the 304.71a. It seems to me that it would have allowed that.
And why is that, Justice?
Well, I'm just saying that if you started out in 62, they already had $300,000, and this is simply a transition or modification or a federalization, and that would have been allowed at that time. That's what I wanted you to answer, and I think Chief Justice asked the question also.
Again, had it taken place in 1962, the equalization would have been across the board in 62. So, yes, in Wisconsin, they would have started in 62 receiving the benefit of that federal bad debt reserve and that corresponding tax deduction.
All right.
However, the adjustment provision is, in essence, and certainly as related to the facts of this case, grants the taxpayer an additional bonus beyond that which they derived from federalization. It allowed, in this case, the taxpayer to go back and recoup the benefit of the federal tax deductions that had been enjoying prior to 1986.
Now, if I understand your argument, you're looking at the statute quite literally and saying each corporation, and this is a corporation, shall calculate as the close of the taxable year 86. No problem about that. The amount that, and then here's important language, because of this act, right, is required to be added to or subtracted from income. And this is a subtraction from income, right? Is that right? We can't hear you.
Yes.
In order to avoid the double inclusion or omission of any item of income, loss, or deduction. Your argument is that this is not an omission because there was nothing to omit in 61 because there was no tax.
That's correct. You can't lose a deduction if you weren't taxed in the first instance. Even though placing the emphasis on the language because of this act, which Lincoln does, even under that argument, I do not believe that they are entitled to the cumulative difference between 1961 and 1986. The department, it is correct, absolutely believes that this statute provision can only be looked at retroactively. Within the language of the provision itself are the parameters of it as of 1986. How else would a taxpayer calculate what deductions they were entitled to if they are not required to determine that by the close of 1986? What has occurred in this case, and I think was very well laid out in the briefs, is that the taxpayer is forced to guess at what it might do in the future. It might reorganize its corporate status and become a credit union. Inherent in that argument is the acknowledgement that if its corporate status does not change, it is going to receive the benefit of a deduction to which it was not entitled. The dangers of deciding hypotheticals, I think, are very well illustrated by this case. We have, as already noted, 11 years that have passed with no change to the taxpayer status. And indeed, if they were to undertake some form of reorganization in the future, this court and the Department of Revenue do not have a crystal ball in which they can see what the federal tax laws as well as the state tax laws will be at that time. It could significantly change at some point in the future. And so to base a tax deduction as of 1986 based on what might happen in the future certainly does not seem to fall under the parameters of the adjustment provision itself.
Ms. Sutherland, suppose they do reorganize or do something else, and then this $309,000 comes into play and looks like they haven't had the benefit of it or can be doubly taxed on it. What's the department going to do then? I mean, their argument is there's nothing in the statute that lets them take advantage of this federalization issue in the future. The department's going to tax them twice or give them no deduction, et cetera.
I don't think we can know that the department will tax Lincoln Savings Bank twice. Obviously, it first would depend on what the current state of federal law is at that time, as well as the state of Wisconsin tax law.
So your answer is you don't know. The statute doesn't cover it.
That's
take
correct.
Your chances like the rest of us.
That's correct. I think the statute can only be fairly read to apply to a taxpayer's status at the time that the statute was enacted, that it cannot be viewed to encompass a taxpayer's voluntary change in tax status at some later point in the future.
Ms. Sutherland, do you see this particular issue as having any effect on any corporations other than the savings and loan involved in this case? In other words, corporations generally.
Certainly the adjustment provision was written to apply to all corporations generally and is not limited to savings and loan. I am not aware of any other corporations that have advanced the argument that Lincoln had, that it is entitled to claim the deductions prospectively.
Prior to 1962, were corporations taxed?
I'm sorry?
Prior to 1962, were corporations taxed in the state on income?
Yes. Savings and loans were exempted from franchise.
And what about banks?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I do not know that information. I'd be happy to submit it to you. No statute, and certainly the adjustment provision at issue here, can anticipate all future scenarios. And inherent in Lincoln's argument, as we were discussing earlier, is the concession that if it does not experience a change in circumstances, it will receive a deduction to which it is not entitled to at this time. While this case is worth some $20,000 to Lincoln, the reality is that accepting its interpretation would deprive the state of millions of dollars of taxable income for savings and loan institutions.
And how much is involved in this case?
I think it's about $23,000.
How do we get to millions?
Because if the court is to accept Lincoln's argument, then that would entitle all savings and loan institutions to go back and claim a deduction, which has not occurred as of this point in Wisconsin.
Isn't there a statute of limitations?
That's certainly a fair question, and I'm not sure, Your Honor, what the statute of limitations would be.
6 years, so 5 years would be 93. If we had a 5-year,
the provision span. Right. The provision ran from 87 to 91, so I'm not quite sure.
Okay, 91. So now we have 5-year time.
Perhaps that's true, Justice.
Is it your position that the statute can be interpreted on plain meaning and is unambiguous?
Yes, it certainly is the department's position that the language of the provision is clear. I mean, I recognize that we have the commission and the courts have bounced back and forth each time they have considered this issue, though this court has held previously that differing interpretations does not necessarily mean that a provision is ambiguous.
Ms. Sutherland, throughout your brief, in fact, through the other counsel's brief, I see the word basis, bases, taxable basis. Are you all referring to the word to the term taxable basis?
Are we all referring to the term?
Do all those words refer to the term taxable basis? And if so, what does the term taxable basis mean?
Do all what words refer to taxable?
I probably spoke too quickly. The words basis appears, taxable basis appears, bases, B-A-S-E-S, appear in your brief, in Mr. Scherer's brief. Are you all referring to the term taxable basis with respect to those words? And if so, what does taxable basis mean?
I don't think that there was any intention to distinguish between the different words that were used. So, yes, I think we were all referring to taxable basis. And I'm not recalling right now exactly where in my brief that was. But in terms of, as I would have presented it in my brief, in terms of the type of deduction that Lincoln is entitled to because of that transitional adjustment provision, it would only be entitled to a deduction for the years in which it was actually taxed in Wisconsin.
What does the term taxable basis mean? Is that the amount upon which they're taxed?
Correct.
All right, now, if you're correct, if you prevail in this case, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the taxable basis for the savings and loan industry would be one thing in the state of Wisconsin and another thing at the federal level. Is that correct?
No.
One figure at the Wisconsin level and one and a different figure at the federal level. Wouldn't the taxable basis be different if you prevail?
No, I don't think that that's correct at all, actually.
Okay.
Taxable income would be different or not? No.
Because federalization has, in fact, taken place. I mean, as of 87, the bad debt reserve is the same, and so the deduction that can be claimed from that bad debt reserve is the same for both federal law and Wisconsin law. And the gross income that would be subject to taxation at the federal level is the same gross income that would be subject to taxation at the Wisconsin level.
Let me try it this way. The federal income tax return would show a bad debt reserve of $3 million, whatever it is. And so would that show on the Wisconsin tax return, the exact same number for the federal, for the bad debt reserve. The difference, however, is that the taxpayer, Lincoln Savings, had the benefit of a deduction for that entire entire bad debt reserve for federal tax purposes, but only had a benefit of $2 million deductions in Wisconsin.
Actually, I don't think that that's correct.
Okay, tell us what you think it is correct.
Yeah.
The tax return will look the same,
right,
but the actual deductions over the years are going to be different.
As of 87, the bad debt reserve was $3 million at the federal level, and that is the same bad debt reserve at the Wisconsin level two. As of 87, Lincoln Savings Bank has been entitled to that full deduction, that full federal bad debt reserve. The only question before this court is whether it gets the additional bonus of prior to 1987, being able to go back and recoup the amount, the difference between the federal and state exemptions. The adjustment provision in this case, and I don't think this is disputed by Lincoln Savings Bank, acts as a bonus to Lincoln Savings Bank for the years prior to 87. The only question is, how big will that bonus be? Will it be $700,000 or $1 million?
I think that's what I said to you. They'll both show $3 million bad debt reserve. The question, though, is how much of that can the Lincoln Savings deduct on the state income tax return? Whether it can deduct $700,000, which is from 62 to 87, right? That's the differential. Or can it deduct $1,000,016, which is the plus the $309,000. But the return is going to look the same.
But the in terms of the Wisconsin return, in comparing the Wisconsin and the federal return, they're going to have a larger deduction with respect to the federal return, correct?
Right.
There's going to be a difference.
Not since 1987, no.
But for the transitional period.
For the transitional period, that's...
Which is correct. The transitional period, there'll be a larger deduction for Wisconsin to make up for either $700,000 or $1 million.
No, there is no transitional period at the federal level. So, I mean, that only operates...
And now the transitional period, we're talking from 87 to 91.
Right, because the...
You know, how does that square with the language of the statute? And certainly the purpose, which is to equalize.
Right, and equalization has taken place as of 87. So the and from 87 to 91 is when this extra bonus, for lack of a better word, is prorated over those 5 years. And the adjustment provision allowed the taxpayer to claim the benefit of the federal rules that govern the bad debt reserve prior to 1987. However, in that language, it states you can only subtract from income the omission of a deduction for purposes of the adjustment provision. Our position is that there has been no omission of a deduction when they were not subject to taxation in 1961 in Wisconsin. In conclusion, Lincoln is seeking a tax deduction for a year in which it was not taxed, 1961. The terms of the adjustment provision itself only permits a subtraction of income where there has been the omission of a deduction. That has not occurred in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sutherland. Mr. Schnur, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Schnur, could you please address the question asked earlier of opposing counsel concerning statute of limitations and the ramifications of our decision as to other savings and loans or even banks?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do so, Your Honor. My a little bit of a hesitancy is I'm not exactly certain what the court can take judicial notice of, but I believe it can take notice of the fact that this is a ineffective test case on behalf of the industry and that the other savings and loans have filed protective refund claims to keep the statute of limitations.
Well, does the industry include credit unions?
No,
does
Your
it
Honor.
Include banks?
No, Your Honor, purely savings and loans.
So your position is this only affects savings and loans because of the difference in tax, franchise tax at that time between savings and loan and other corporations.
Yes, and the difference in the way federal law, the federal income tax treats, credit unions aren't taxed at all. Banks are not basically allowed to use bad debt reserves. For
banks are not allowed to use bad
debt reserves. Not for some 10 years or so.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to take the opportunity to correct one misstatement that Ms. Sutherland made. I'm not sure if she meant it or not, but it goes to some of the questions that were raised here. It's quite clear under the state's position, and I think they're correct, that as a result of federalization, the Wisconsin and federal bad debt reserves were equalized. So as of the eve of federalization, the taxpayer had, I think it was approximately $3.8 million federal reserve, approximately a $2.8 million Wisconsin reserve. On account of federalization, that reserve was automatically equalized so that there was an additional $1 million reserve given. Ms. Sutherland stated that we've received a tax benefit for that entire amount, and that's just inaccurate. For federal purposes, we had. For Wisconsin purposes, and that's the very core of our case, is that we had never received a tax benefit for that $300,000. That by equalizing to increase our reserve by $1 million, we say that the state is obligated, and that's what Section 3047(1A) is intended to cause, we should get a $1 million deduction to equal that reserve, as is the case whenever you have an increase in your bad debt reserve. The other point I'd like to make is that Ms. Sutherland still has, using her backwards-looking approach, has, I think, failed to focus again on the statutory language. The omissions, the double inclusions of income that were intended to be remedied here were omissions caused, quote, because of the act. And I think we have to, in light of that language, I don't see how we can look backward. We have to indeed look forward. In our situation, last point I'm going to make, Sutherland has made quite a bit about that we're going to have a windfall because our increase in income in the future is hypothetical. I suggest that it is not hypothetical at all. By the very nature of the way a bad debt reserve functions, that bad debt reserve over the life of the taxpayer, maybe that'll take a long time, maybe it won't. Over the life of that taxpayer, that bad debt reserve will come back into income because that's what bad debt reserves are intended to do. So we suggest that this is not hypothetical at all. We have indeed omitted a $300,000 deduction, that being the amount required to get to equalize our bad debt reserves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schnur. That ends this discussion, and I'm sure that all the students from Albany High School think they'd like to be tax lawyers.
See, if you know anything about the Battle of the Bays, maybe that's
enough. Okay.
Everybody give a
now,
big stretch.
Yeah, everybody should stand up here. Now, we've got a few minutes to go. I don't know if the Chief Justice is here.
Yes, he is.
Good. And you from Edison Middle School will be joined by Albany High and Whitney.